Coming up on this episode, Adeep Khorum joins us to talk about the breakup lists. Hello, Rainbow Romance Reader. Welcome to episode 452 of the Big Gay Fiction Podcast, the show for avid readers and passionate fans of queer romance fiction. I'm Jeff, and it's great to have you here for another episode. Now, before we get into my conversation with Adeep, I want to tell you briefly about a new charity anthology that's coming out this Thursday, April 26. 13 authors have joined together for Elite Connections. Let me just read you this blurb to get you intrigued about this. Every need met, every desire fulfilled. Welcome to Elite Connections, the secret exclusive service where money is no object and your every wish is guaranteed to come true. Fake dates, arranged marriages, or just some company for the night. Whatever it is, with Elite, you are covered. Elite Connections is a queer charity anthology containing MM, FF, and other LGBTQ+ romances, and it's available for a limited time only. Now, if that didn't make you want to pick up a copy, this should. The proceeds from the anthology are being split between two organizations that do some incredible work. First is Outright International, an organization that works to amplify inclusion and equality across the world. And second is Lambda Legal, which fights for the civil rights of LGBTQ+ people. This is a great lineup of authors, too, featuring Anna Ashley, B.A. Tortuga, Colette Davison, Emily Silver, Aaron Jacks, Jax Calder, Calix, Francis M. Thompson, Jody Payne, Reese Everly, Sarah Zane, Saxon James, and V.L. Losey. I hope you'll pick up a copy of Elite Connections for some great stories and to support these two organizations doing great work. Now let's get into my conversation with Adeep Khorum. Usually, I review the book before the interview, and we talk about absolutely everything I love about the breakup lists in the interview. So rather than being redundant, I think we should just get right to it. I really love talking to Adeep about this book and the real-life inspirations behind some aspects of the story. Adeep's also got two more books coming out this year, including his first adult romance that we're going to find out about. And he's got some terrific recommendations, too. Adeep, welcome to the show. It is so exciting to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've been thinking about having you, of course, going back to Darius the Great is not okay, but then you came out with The Breakup Lists. This book and its theater kid scenario, kind of a high school musical thing overall going on. It's like, okay, now's the time. Got to have him here. Tell us about this book and the story of Jackson and Liam.
Goodness. So The Breakup Lists tells the story of Jackson Ghaznavi, who is an Iranian-American gay deaf stage manager in his high school in Kansas City, Missouri, who's quite cynical and whose older sister is constantly falling in and out of love. And to help her cope and to give himself some peace in life, he's taken to making lists of all of the faults of her most recent exes, which he calls his The Breakup Lists. At the start of The Breakup Lists, he meets a boy named Liam. He has kind of known Liam because Liam is a swimmer and Jackson's best friend Bowie is a swimmer. But Liam decides he's going to audition for the fall musical, even though he's never been a theater kid and the theater kids tend to be a bit territorial. That's a nice way of putting it.
That's a good way to put it.
Indeed. But Jackson gets to know Liam and gets to really like Liam about the same time that his sister Jasmine is also getting to know Liam and falling in love with him. And so even though Liam is dating his sister, Jasmine, Jackson comes to realize that he may also have a bit of a crush. And geez, I don't know how far to go into it. I feel like that's a good like top level pitch without spoiling any of the chaos that ensues. But if you want me to go into the chaos that ensues, I will. I just don't want to spoil things. I never know how much to pitch.
We'll get into some of those deep dive things a little
bit.
Suffice
it to say, it is a romance, so you kind of know that Jackson and Liam are in fact going to end up together at the other end of the mess.
Although
the genre, I don't make them, I just follow them.
This is one of those books that people on the show have heard me talk about from time to time. It's like the mess is so big. It's like I don't know how they're going to come back from that to get to where I know they have to go. And that's kind of my favorite, right? That I can't figure out how it's going to like put us all self back together again. And also one of those I just kept with Jackson going, oh, don't do that. Don't do that.
I feel like for me, the best YA books are the ones where we can see someone making the same mistakes we made at that age and being like, oh, I 100% understand why you're doing this. And I 100% wish I could just tell you to make a different choice. But I don't know. I think that's what makes them real, because we all have made those mistakes when we were younger.
Yeah.
Sometimes we still make those mistakes as an adult. I often hear people say that they're like, really don't like the miscommunication trope. And I'm like, listen, I'm almost 40 and I still sometimes miscommunicate with the people in my life. I get it. But obviously not yuck anyone's yum or yum anyone's yuck. Like, everyone is allowed to like what they want to like.
You mentioned in the acknowledgments that you were a theater kid.
I was indeed.
Where are the parallels between you and Jackson?
Goodness. You know, Jackson is not me, thank goodness. And he's not me in a lot of ways. But like Jackson, I was also a techie. You know, I was backstage. I actually got my college degree in lighting design. And though Jackson's very much not me, I think I gave him some of what, you know, with hindsight, I think were some of my rougher edges from when I was a teenager. I was maybe a little bit on the judgmental side and maybe a little bit of a grudge holder and maybe a little bit cynical. And I think I gave those parts of myself to Jackson. But he's also very much his own person. He's self-possessed in a way that I wish I was when I was a teenager. He's also out and queer, which I definitely could not be growing up in Kansas City in, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s. And so in those ways, I think he's very different from me. But the love of theater that I had and still have, I think, are very much a part of him. And, you know, as the stage manager, his job is not to be on stage. His job is to make sure everything goes well. And I think that's part of who I was as a teenager and who I still am in some ways as an adult. Before being an author, I spent more than 10 years in the event production industry in Kansas City, making like live events happen for people. And so I've always been, I think, pretty good at keeping multiple plates spinning and, you know, subsuming my own ego enough to let someone else have the night be about them and have a good time. And I think that's something I gave to Jackson too, because for all of his faults, and they are numerous, I don't think he's a very selfish person most of the time.
I would agree with that. He really wants things to go well for everybody. Mostly, I mean, he definitely has that, like, I want things to go well for me, but, you know, he wants the shows to go off well. And I certainly, having stage managed a few things myself, although as an adult, I certainly appreciate all the things that has to go into, like, making that happen correctly and well, night after night after night, you know, performance after performance. And I thought that stuff was just brilliant, because I could, The Notebook. Mm-hmm.
Yep, many, many of the hurdles he faced were drawn from my own large repertoire of theater stories, as I think anyone who's been in the theater for any amount of time just has a bunch of weird stories.
The thing that I love most about Jackson, and we'll see how not spoilerly we can kind of keep ourselves here, but just how much he misses clues about how Liam feels about him. He's just like, or sometimes he's like, because Bowie will kind of try to nudge him. He's like, no. It's like, this guy's learning sign language for you. He's learning another language for you. Please see that.
I think, you know, for all of his self-confidence, and Jackson is pretty self-confident in a lot of ways and self-assured, but he also is insecure in a lot of ways, and in particular in romance, because he's been burned quite badly by his only other experience. And I think this is something that I imagine a lot of queer people have to grapple with when they were growing up, especially my generation, of not quite believing that you're deserving or worthy of love. And I think that really comes through in Jackson, that to admit that Liam might actually like him means to admit that he's worthy of love. And he has built his entire personality on being cynical because he is not lovable. And he just doesn't know how to accept that maybe he in fact is. And so it's much easier to be like, it's all in my head. It's wishful thinking. This is a normal bro behavior, even though it's clearly not a bro behavior.
Clearly not. Did you have to fight with yourself a little bit to let that play out as long as it did, and to not kind of nudge it further? Because it's almost, in a lot of ways, a slow burn that's going on there.
Actually, my editor had to fight with me to make the book not 800 pages long because the burn was slower to start with. And I was like, let me relish all of these little hints and clues, and Jackson being so like blinded by what's going on, and Liam being so obvious, and Jackson's still not getting it. And my editor's like, I love how self-indulgent we're being. Let's just rein it in a little bit. We really want to come, we really want to hit. I don't remember exactly what the page count is, but usually, however big the book is depends, how it gets placed in libraries, how much it costs to print, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, we really think this is the sweet spot. So maybe just rein it in just a little, just a little. And I did. And I do think the book is stronger for it. Like, I think it moves along at a nice pace. And I don't think it feels rushed, but I think it has a certain urgency to it that you want to know what happens next.
It was definitely a page turner for me. It's like, oh, I just want to read a little bit more before, before I have to put it down for a bit.
Which is good. We can save all of the other slow burn scenes for the director's cut.
Exactly what I was thinking. That's the, later on, this can have a special edition with everything you wanted extra in it. Is there anything that got left on the cutting room floor that you're like, oh, I wished that thing could have snuck its way back in?
One of the scenes I held on to for probably longer than I should have because it just wasn't working was drawn from my own theater days, where Jackson and the other theater kids try to have a camp out outside the theater teacher's house, and the cops get called on them. And so they end up decamping to a local park where they set up tents. And Jackson, having never been camping before, enters into an only one tent scenario with Liam. It was tropey and fun and just didn't quite work for the arc of their relationship or the arc of the plot. But it was very fun and really just felt like the sort of misadventures that theater kids have, because I did, in fact, have such a misadventure when I was in high school. I'm definitely sad that that one didn't survive the editorial process, but that just means I can put it in a different book someday. Knock on wood.
There you go. And now we all know it too. It's like, oh, I can just work that into my own head story for those two on a thing that
Exactly.
didn't actually show up in the book. I've got to ask about these breakup lists because this is so unique that you've got somebody maintaining the lists for somebody else, not just somebody else going, I hate this person because of XYZ, but having somebody maintain it for them, almost like their social secretary in some way. What was the inspiration for making that kind of come about? And I know, because you mentioned the acknowledgments too, like leaning on some of the stuff with your sister a little bit too. Were you her social secretary?
I'm only saying this because my sister gave me permission to say this. I was her social secretary for one particularly nasty breakup that she had, where she just was having a really hard time getting over this guy. And so to make her laugh and cheer her up, I just started inventing the most ridiculous faults I could for this guy. Some of them were clearly not untrue, or perhaps not even applicable to members of the human species, but nonetheless, I would just make up the most ridiculous things about him. And that always did get a laugh out of her. And it's something that even now, she's well and truly over it and healed, but she will occasionally just like remember something I said and as I was making this list of faults and just like crack herself up and we'll have a good laugh about it. And I was describing this to another one of my author friends, and they're like, that's kind of a fun hook for a book. And I'm like, oh my God, you're right. I cannot write this book without getting my sister's permission first. And so she did thankfully give it. And so, it spiraled out of, I did this one time for one guy. Well, what if it's someone, what if it's a character doing it for like every guy because their sister is a serial dater? And then, of course, the logical conclusion was, well, what if he has a hard time making a list because he likes the guy that he's making one for? And that was really the seed of the entire novel.
Interesting how many lists that he had to keep because she is that serial dater. And I love how it's represented in the book in places too. And even some of the ways that his internal monologue works, because there are places that you can see in the book, like where things are scratched out and something else is like written next to it or just crossed out. Or as he's editing his own thoughts, even it's like, cross out, here's what I'm really thinking or saying or whatever. It's a very interesting device that I can't remember seeing anywhere quite like that before, to see that level of like character self-editing in the monologues, if you will.
Thank you. I wish I knew where that came from. I tend to write by the seat of my pants when I'm kind of deepest into my writing. I do sometimes outline things as necessary, But I'm like at my happiest when I can just kind of sit down and write. And so I don't always know where things came from. And that emerged pretty organically early on, that I'm like, oh, Jackson is afraid to say what he really thinks, so he's constantly censoring himself. I want to say it was my agent who said that there are other books that have done similar, but it's been a while since we've had a book that use it similarly. And so hopefully everyone will have forgotten all of the others and think I'm a genius. And I'm like, yes, please. That would be wonderful. But it definitely, it was just a lot of fun being like, let me make him as mean as he can possibly be. And then he's redacted that. And here's the milder version. And, you know, I think with queer people and with people of color and with disabled people, often we're, you know, filing off little edges of ourselves to make ourselves more palatable to other people. And so having kind of done it on a whim, I'm like, oh, this feels a little too real, but now I have to do it because it just felt like something a lot of us have experienced.
It was really a wonderful reading experience to see all of those elements of Jackson, like the what I really want to say, and then even redacting it almost to himself, like lessening what he'd said in his mind a little bit too. And I just wanted to hug him so much and just say like, this is all okay. The deaf representation you've got here with Jackson is something that kind of blew me away in the book. Listeners to the podcast know that I work in digital accessibility. So I'm considering these elements all the time and working with people who are in the disabled community. And I've heard people discuss deafness and loss of hearing with needing to turn hearing aids off because it gets to be too much trying to process and the effort in trying to process even with hearing aids. And then I love how in the dialogue portions, if Jackson's not hearing correctly, it just is like something, something just written in the dialogue. So you know, as the reader, that something happened that he didn't understand. First of all, thank you for putting that in the book, because while I'm not deaf or hard of hearing myself, I certainly appreciate the representation that people are going to see themselves in this book in a way that they may not have elsewhere. What kind of help and support and research did you do to be able to write that with what, again, appears only to me as a non-deaf person to be some really excellent representation?
Thank you. I'm also not deaf or hard of hearing. When I was younger, I did speech therapy. It turns out they were trying to get rid of my gay voice, but at the time they thought I had a speech impediment and made me go to speech therapy for like 6 months. And several of the other kids in there were deaf and hard of hearing. So that was like my first introduction to that community. But it's not one I'm part of. And as a writer, you know, my thinking around, you know, who gets to tell what stories is constantly evolving. And these days I find myself feeling like at the end of the day, we have to make more space than we take. Early on, I've envisioned Jackson as deaf. There are people in my life that are deaf or hard of hearing. Some of them are, you know, minors, and I'm not going to talk about them, but suffice it to say, people I care about very much are deaf or hard of hearing. And I was cognizant that while representation of deaf folks is increasing in children's literature, it's still not a whole lot. Almost all that I could find was by white authors. And it's exciting that we're getting more books by deaf creators like Sophie Lang and Anna Sortino, who both have Sophie's debut is this year, and then Anna's sophomore novel comes out this year, both with deaf protagonists written by deaf authors. And certainly in the adult space, deaf writers have been writing. So I felt like there was enough other books out there that I could join in and make some room rather than taking it up. And hopefully that will end up being the case. But as far as research, aside from talking to the deaf folks in my life, I did read as much literature by deaf people as I could find. One of my favorites was actually Sarah Novick's True Biz, which was recommended to me by my friend who's a CODA, a child of deaf adults, because their mother read it and was like, oh my God, this book is amazing. You have to read it. And so down the chain, it came to me. I also watched one of my favorite pieces of deaf media I watched was Deaf U, the documentary on Netflix about Gallaudet University. That was really fun. And then I also, as many writers did, worked with an authenticity reader to find basically all the points of ignorance I had that I butted up against. I went into writing with the philosophy that it's not my job to put my thumb on a pain point that I don't share in. And so the, you know, in earlier versions, there was less of Jackson hearing something, something, and there was less of him being frustrated with his family's unwillingness to learn sign language. And the reader said something to the effect of, basically, it felt almost idealized that he wasn't more frustrated with what was going on around him. And so then I had to make the decision of, like, how honest do I need to be here to, you know, accurately represent his reality without, again, just jabbing a pain point that's not mine. And I think, you know, with the help of that reader and with the help of my editor, I hope I've done it justice and come to a happy place. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm human and we all make mistakes sometime. And so I hope if I did make any mistakes, they are minor and don't cause any harm, because that's certainly not my goal. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that was really rambly. I hope that made sense.
It did make sense. And I hope, like you, that there aren't mistakes there that you weren't aware of. It didn't surface. It'll be interesting as this gets out into people's hands to see how all that resonates with people. And I hope it resonates for them in a good way. Because I like seeing that kind of representation, just, you know, knowing the work that I do and how little representation there can be in certain spaces.
I hope so too. And I hope, you know, I hope young deaf readers and young deaf readers of color will see the book and be like, oh, I get to write about my own experiences too. And that mm-hmm. it will open doors and not close them.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, over on the theater geeking outside, I very much want to see the version of Jesus Christ Superstar that you've portrayed in this book. I have been through versions of JCS that I both adore how they do things, and other ones where I'm like, how did you decide to do that thing? I want to see the thing that you did in that book. So if you ever put that on somewhere, let me know where that's happening.
Oh, no, I won't. It did happen in real life. And
it did.
We did get fined for veering too far from Andrew Lloyd Webber's vision and lost a huge chunk of their season's budget.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sad that I missed that somewhere.
Indeed. For those listeners who haven't read the book yet, the version of Jesus Christ Superstar that Jackson's teacher decides to mount is one that leans really heavily into the homoerotic subtexts of Jesus and Judas. And that was very much based on a production I was tangentially involved with, in which those same choices were made and cost the theater company a lot of money.
Wow. You always hear about those things that kind of happen when they veer too far off, and to know that Indeed. This was real, it's like, wow. Indeed.
And I feel comfortable saying this. It was an adult theater company, not a children's theater. And so I will say that was definitely the sexiest that Jesus Christ Superstar has ever been. The guy they had playing Jesus was a very attractive man.
Nice. And so I guess I was going to ask, you know, why did you choose JCS? And I'm guessing that whole incident might have been one of the reasons it made its way into the book.
It actually was the last reason I picked Jesus Christ Superstar. I really picked it primarily because in earlier versions of the book, betrayal was perhaps a larger theme than ended up being in the final version. And so it felt thematically appropriate to have them be doing Jesus Christ Superstar, especially when they later go on to do 12th Night, which is about, am I allowed to cuss on this?
Oh, absolutely.
It's about gender fuckery and siblings. And I'm like, yes, also a big theme. I'm a genius. These are illusions. Oh my God, English teachers are going to be obsessed with me. But so once I had, you know, the idea that I wanted to be something about betrayal, I'm like, well, I know I had this one hilarious production of Jesus Christ Superstar I was once involved in. That'll be hilarious and great. And so once I had made the decision, I very much leaned into it and enjoyed getting to use this part of my past.
That's awesome. I love that so, so much. And I mean, even still, there's some big betrayal that goes on in this book. All I'll say is, as things start to kind of come together, Jackson's sister, like, just blew my mind with the lengths that she went on some of what she did. And that's all I'll say on that. But it's like, whoa.
It felt like that was the only choice she really could make for the narrative to have meaning and to feel satisfying, like she had to do what she did. But I did not have a lot of fun. I don't like writing people being mean. I had a really hard time. That was really one of the last pieces of the book to fall in place was kind of Jasmine getting even with Jackson for stealing her boyfriend, even though they had already broken up beforehand. And yeah, it's been interesting. You know, I've started seeing kind of early responses to the book from people, and Jasmine has been a more polarizing character than I had expected. I think she's delightful and hilarious. And I feel like we all know or knew when we were teenagers that one person who literally is just like has to be in a relationship. And so I find her very human and endearing in a way, even as she's messy. And some people are like, she's unlikable. And then I'm like, is this misogyny at work? Or is this just people like seeing a little too much of themselves in the character and being like, no. Like, I don't know, maybe people doth protest too much. You never know.
She was interesting. She's the character I had the most difficulty with. Right. Just like, why are you putting your brother through this thing with the lists? That's kind of where I was with it. I mean, it wasn't like that she was completely fair. Unlikable. It's just like, why aren't you keeping your own lists kind of thing?
And to be fair, I mean, that dynamic is just as much Jackson, who is like, let me tell you what's wrong with your Jackson.
That's very true.
Jackson does like listing people's faults.
You have a lot of subplots in this book. I mean, you've got everything
really?
With everything with the
My
sister.
My editor made me pare them down.
I can only imagine the subplots that are in the director's cut. But I mean, you've got everything with Jackson's sister. There's stuff with the school's GSA, which we haven't even really touched on here, but some things going on there. Jackson's friend Bowie, who I would love to see an entire book about. College application and decision time, staging two plays. How did you and your editor kind of bring all this into the package that it became? And how long did it take? It feels like this book might have taken a while.
It definitely took, I think, 4 good rounds of edits, plus pretty substantive line edits. I would say generally, I tended to write too much. I got too in the weeds with subplots. And so it was basically constantly my editor reining me in and saying, remember, this is a romance or a romantic comedy, depending who you ask. We're going to be here for 3 hours if we try to define what a romance versus a romantic comedy is to the satisfaction of everyone on the planet. And I'm not sure it's actually possible. But because it's a romance, like, you know, the thrust has to be thrust. Well, that's a different romance. But the point of the story has to be Jackson and Liam. And so, yes, make sure all the other characters have rich internal lives. But if they're distracting from will Jackson and Liam have a happy ever after or not, then we gotta either cut it or trim it down to use it kind of as breathing room for when Jackson and Liam are getting too intense. Let's go follow someone else for a little while. It really was just a constant matter of pruning, really. I rarely added to the subplots. It was usually trim the subplot to have a little more room to flesh out something between Jackson and Liam. And it was a real challenge, but like it was a good challenge. It made me really consider how much space I was giving on the page to any given subplot and how to do as much as I could with as little page space as I could. And I'm always a fan of scenes that can do more than one thing at a time. This book and my editor, Ellen, really like made me do that a lot, which I think at the end of the day was good for me as a writer to have some bumpers to bowl up against, as it were.
Has this method where you've got too much in it and have to pare back, is that kind of common for what happens with you write, or did this book just kind of bring more out of you and story to tell?
I think usually I end up writing a little bit short or writing just about the right amount, and therefore it's just kind of a matter of shuffling. This one I definitely wrote too much. I think part of it is because it was characters I loved so much and, you know, a topic and a piece of my life that I loved so much that it was a very self-indulgent writing process because it's part of my life that I love and that I had endless funny stories. And so I just put like all of the funny stories from my theater days into it. And part of the editing process was just being like, which ones are the funniest and which ones actually drive the plot forward or are so funny we have to leave them anyway. The constant writing advice is to kill your darlings. And I always give myself the power to pardon one darling per book that I just keep it in there because it makes me happy.
What got pardoned for this one?
Oh my gosh, I knew you were going to ask that as soon as I said it aloud and I can't remember.
Oh, I couldn't let it go.
I know, right? Well, the problem is, like, I finished the book like last year. when I'm done with it, and then when it actually comes out, there's such a gap that sometimes I forget what did. Oh my gosh. Okay. Actually, one of the darlings I did pardon was actually keeping them doing two plays. The question was asked, like, can I combine it into one? I was like, no. No, I think they need to do a fall musical and a spring play. So that meant I had to work harder to make it work, which is sometimes the compromises. You can keep the starling, but you have to earn it. And I do think I earned that. Like, I think it works the way it turned out, though.
I can't imagine it another way because the black moments happen shortly after JCS and kind of leaning into the next show. And you needed the space for all of the things that went so wrong to eventually work themselves out. And if you'd like solved it sooner, I think it would have been felt like, well, why did we just rush all of that? It's what it needed to tell its story, at
I
least in my
felt
opinion.
I was happy with how it turned out. It definitely took a while to get there, but I was very happy with how the book turned out. And really grateful to Ellen for making me stretch and making me make it good.
Given your love of these characters, do you think you might revisit at some point? Like I said, I want a book about Bowie really badly.
You know, I never say never. For me, I always have to have a story to tell. I feel like if there's not a story there, then in a way it feels like writing fan fiction of my own characters, which feels enough that there's anything wrong with fan fiction. But writing fan fiction of your own characters feels self-indulgent to me, and in some ways like diminishing the role of and the joy of fan fiction. Like, one of the joys of fan fiction is filling in the gaps. Or of imagining how the story goes on after the end. And I feel like if I'm going to tell you what happens after the end by writing another book, it has to be a good story worthy of being told, or there's no point to doing it. So, all of which to say, if I ever come up with the right story for them, and also someone buys it, then I would absolutely write about them again.
We talked about something that was on the cutting room floor that, you wish it could come back in. But what's a favorite scene in the final book?
I mean, one of my favorite small interactions comes at a holiday meal where Jackson's dad, who's Iranian American and is really bad at cooking vegetables, wants Jackson to come check the carrots he's cooking. And he's like, "Do you think they're cooked enough?" And Jackson's like, "How long have they been in this boiling water?" And he's like, "About 45 minutes." And Jackson touches the carrot and it just like dissolves in the water. And he's like, "Yep, they're dead." I think that was really funny because I feel like a lot of Iranian American children come from families that have tended to murder vegetables. Like, we all make fun of our parents for overcooking vegetables. And so that's a favorite scene. I also think, I don't know, Liam has this habit of tucking in Jackson's t-shirt tags because they always end up sticking up. And I feel like every time I got to write Liam doing that, I was like, oh, like that was my favorite thing to do. It was just let me show Liam being tender to this boy who is all bristles and like get through his shell. That was really fun because I think it's, I don't know, it's nice to write about queer characters falling in love and nice to write about a queer character being shown that they're worthy of love.
And Liam, in all of his just kindness, I mean, I don't feel like there's an evil bone really in Liam's person. He's nice and he's kind and he wants to do right by people and do right by himself. And so of course he's going to tuck that tag in. And it was just like, I loved it every time I read it. It's like, oh.
I was like, yes, psychological gesture. Excellent. You know, me and my editor talked a lot about like Liam and make sure, like, yes, he is perfect, but also he is very imperfect. And one of the things I actually struggled with during the editing process was how to get across that, like, yeah, he's great. Yeah, he's kind, but he's also kind of a people pleaser. And like, how to show him growing through that and like learning to take care of himself in a way that was possible when we were 100% in Jackson's head. And like, that was a great challenge, but one I hope I rose to.
I think you did. I could think of a couple scenes, and I won't give them away, where you see Liam have to take that leap into a little personal growth with how he's handling a few different things that crop up along the way. it occasionally made me wonder, like, this could be an interesting two-person POV. But on the other hand, I like just being with Jackson too.
I think it would have been interesting, but I think Jackson's personality is just a little too strong to share the page with someone else.
I could just envision Jackson somewhere in your head going, what are you doing? No, this is my book.
Exactly.
You've got a couple more books coming out this year. It's a busy year for you. There's a picture book and a romantic comedy. You could try to define romantic comedy maybe with that book.
I'm not going to try.
What can you tell us about these two?
So the picture book is called Bijan Always Wins, and it comes out in July. And it's about a little boy named Bijan, who basically makes everything in his life a competition to be won, and then ends up just really making everyone in his life really, really mad. And it's illustrated by Michelle Tran, who just did a fantastic job, like, entirely throughout. It's such a fun, cute, but funny and whimsical picture book. I'm really excited for it. And if you're wondering if as a child, I also was overly competitive. I don't remember anymore. That's too long ago now. I'm actually, in addition to having three books out this year, not to age myself, but I'm turning 40 this year as well. So it's like the year of Adib. In fact, actually, maybe that's a branding opportunity. I should get with the year people and see if we can make it the year of Adib.
Absolutely.
Or just smack my, like, put a sticker of my face over a dragon, and that way it can, like, do double duty. And then my debut adult romance is called I'll Have What He's Having, and it comes out in September. And it's about an Iranian-American man named Farzan, who lives in Kansas City, and he and his two Iranian-American gay best friends from high school are still, like, best friends forever. When Farzan goes to restaurants, sometimes he uses the name Frank Allen, because his real name is Farzan Alavi, but when you try to make a reservation, sometimes people are like, what? And so his white person name is Frank Allen. And so after getting dumped by a guy that he'd been on three dates with and is about to, like, start, like, finally he's having this guy over, he's going to cook for him, and maybe they're going to Netflix and chill afterward. But the guy is like, I'm not feeling it, and cancels on him. And so Farzan goes to a restaurant he's wanted to try and gives his white person named Frank Allen for the reservation, forgetting that Frank Allen is also the name of, like, a famous restaurant critic in Kansas City, not in real life, but in the Kansas City of the book. And so the sommelier at this restaurant named David, who is studying for his master sommelier test, is like, oh crap, a critic's coming. I got to roll out the red carpet for him. So he starts basically giving Farzan a lot of free food and a lot of free wine. And Farzan thinks David is flirting with him, and David thinks Farzan / Frank is flirting with him. So they end up going home and sleeping together. And the next morning, realizing that it was all a mistake. David is studying for his sommelier test, which is very stressful. And Farzan has just agreed to take over his family's Persian restaurant in Kansas City, even though he doesn't know how to run a restaurant. And so they're like, ah, what if you help me study for my test and I help you learn how to run a restaurant? And also we bone sometimes. Surely we won't catch any feelings. This is a purely professional transaction. We're just letting off stress. And of course, naturally, they do catch feelings. Drama ensues, but there's a lot of wine and a lot of boning. And I would say it's maybe like 4 chili peppers on a scale of 5. I know everyone has their versions of what that is. Suffice it to say, it's not a children's book. Very much not a children's book.
What led you to get into adult romance after doing, you know, some picture books and some YA along the way?
I think probably like a lot of people, I had a hard time reading any books for pleasure during the kind of worst parts of the pandemic. And so I started reading basically exclusively adult romance because I'm like, this will be happy. And it's about people falling in love and boning, none of which I'm able to do during the pandemic because I was single at the start of the pandemic. And like, I didn't need any pandemic. You know, growing up, I read romance some, usually by, you know, appropriating various family members' Harlequin novels, because certainly as a closeted gay boy, you're not supposed to be reading romance. So it was a genre I always loved and appreciated. Reading a bunch of it in 2020 and 2021, like, I was reading queer romances and romances by authors of color, which weren't around when I, you know, was growing up. Or at least I'm sure they were around, but I was not exposed to them and they were harder to find. And I was just reading so many of them and loving them. But at the same time, there weren't a whole lot of traditionally published romances by queer men of color. There were some, and there are more now than there were, but I was like, none of these are by gay Iranians. So at least none of the ones I could find Like, there probably are some. Romance is such a big genre, and certainly the, you know, the presence of indie romance is a beautiful thing. But it makes it hard to know if what you want actually exists, and it's hard to find, or if it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So I won't claim that I'm the first gay Iranian man to be writing queer romances, but I wasn't finding a lot of it. And I was like, I should write romances about people like me. And then separate to that, I also helped two different friends move house on two different days. And then my body was destroyed and I drank a bottle of wine and ate a pizza by myself. And then I was like, man, I should go to Italy. And so I booked myself a trip to Italy and then sobered up and I was like, emailed my agent Molly. And I was like, dear Molly, I am going to Italy and I need to make this a write-off. What if one of my romances is set in Italy? And she was like, great. So book two is set in Italy. It's three books, by the way. Three books for three friends. Awesome. Middle one is in Italy to make my trip a tax write-off. Also, I'm not a tax professional. Don't take tax advice from me on what to do if you go to Italy.
But a great way to make Italy work for you. That was wonderful. All right. And three books, three romance books coming out. That's exciting. Yeah,
fall 2024, fall 2025, and fall 2026. So I'm deep in edits on the second one right now.
Do you see for the future just kind of going back and forth a little bit between writing young adult and also writing adult romance? Or is this more of a transition, perhaps?
I think so. I love writing for young people. They are endlessly fascinating. And, you know, in a lot of ways, every experience for them is a first. And so when I get to write about their experiences, I get to kind of rediscover things for myself. And that's incredibly fulfilling. And I also think even though queer literature has come a long way, there's always room for more. And I think with the current climate in the United States around access to books for young people, you know, it's more important than ever that we let young people and young queer people know that there is a future out there for them and there is a world that will welcome them despite what the ugliest adults in their lives are saying. And so, yeah, I think I'm going to keep writing both. But on the other hand, I've had so much fun writing adult romance that I would love to do more if they'll let me. I already have ideas for, you know, more books, different scenarios, different tropes that I haven't gotten to get into, but want to get into. So, yeah, I can see myself doing both as long as they'll let me.
That's exciting. Oh, I'm looking forward to the fall to check out the adult romance, especially, you know, for Chili Pepper Spicy, because you're certainly not writing that in young adult.
No, right? I haven't put any pole and hole in any of my young adult books, and I can't imagine myself doing that. But this is an adult book, and I'm like, yep, they're just going to get a little messy.
We do love to get recommendations on this show. So what are you reading or watching, or even what theater have you been to recently that you want to tell our listeners to check out?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So like every other person that has ever done this podcast, as soon as you asked the question, I immediately forgot every book I have ever read in my life.
Oh, yeah.
I had a list next to me. I had a list prepared in case this came up. So I've read Julian Winter's adult romance debut, I Think They Love You, which is delightful and amazing. I recently read Martha Wells' System Collapse, the latest in the Murderbot novellas. I recently read Natalie C. Parker's Assassin's Guide to Babysitting, a YA queer adventure about assassins trying to kill a babysitter, who's also an assassin, to be clear. They're all assassins. It's great and delightful. And I've also been rereading Rebecca Weatherspoon's Rafe Above Male Nanny, which is just one of my favorite romances of all time. Also, theater-wise, I mean, I think it closed now, but if you have a time machine, go back in time and see Some Like It Hot on Broadway. It's the queerest, most delightful musical I've ever seen in my life. I saw it three times. I'm just obsessed with it. It was so perfect. And everything you would want writers to do to a movie about white men dressing up as women to escape mobsters in a movie in the 50s, like everything you would want them to do to update that to be relevant to today, they did, and more. It was so great. So if it goes on tour, if they ever remount it, go see Some Like It Hot. It's great. And then my other obsession has been Baldur's Gate 3, which I think I'm coming up on 400 hours of playtime on. I'm on my third and a half playthrough right now. I'm finally doing a Dark Urge run, and I made my Dark Urge so sexy. It's terrible. I'm like, oh no. Oh no. He's so attractive. What happened? And it's funny because in the character creator, sometimes you like think, ah, this person's going to be hot. And then you see them in the in-game lighting and you're like, oh, you look kind of weird. This time I thought they looked kind of weird in the character creator. But then once it's in the game lighting, I'm like, oh no. So I've sabotaged myself. It's such a good game, though. It's so good.
That is some great stuff there. I am so excited for Julian's adult romance debut because I love everything he writes, and I can't wait to get a hold of that. And I'm so annoyed that I didn't get to Some Like It Hot before it closed.
I'm so sorry. It was so good.
Yeah, I was thrilled that they won a Grammy for cast recording.
Oh, that's great. I was so happy that Jay Harrison Gee won. Them and Alex Newell tied for being the first non-binary performers to win Tonys. And I was so thrilled for that.
Adib, this has been such a wonderful conversation. As we wrap up, tell everybody the best places to keep up with you online so that they can know when all of your new books are coming out and other things you may be doing as the Breakup Lists comes out into the world.
Yeah. First of all, Jeff, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Assuming there is social media by the time this podcast comes out, and given how many temper tantrums Elon Musk seems to throw, who knows what the answer will be. I am on Instagram, and I usually forget to post unless it's a picture of my food, at Adib Koram. I'm also on Blue Sky, which is, I think, my new Twitter. I feel like half of Book World went to Threads and the other half went to Blue Sky, and I was on the Blue Sky side because I don't like Meta very much. But also at Adib Koram. I have a website, adibkoram.com. And I actually have a monthly newsletter that I've been sending out, I think, for the last 2 or 2.5 years every month, which I'm very proud of myself because that's a very impressive consistency rate for me. But yeah, you know, I'm really lucky in some ways that I have a name that not a whole lot of other authors have. And so I didn't have to do anything weird to my name to get it on every social media that I wanted. Also, if you love Star Trek or The Untamed, or random cultural musings, I do also have a Tumblr, and it's basically all Star Trek and The Untamed, because those are my great loves. So, and that's also adibkoram.tumblr.com.
Fantastic. We will link to all of that in the show notes, along with all the other things that we talked about in the show. Thank you so much for being here. I've enjoyed this conversation so, so much. Wish you all the success with the Breakup Lists.
Thank you very much. I had a blast.
This episode's transcript has been brought to you by our community on Patreon. If you'd like to read the conversation for yourself, check out the show notes page for this episode at biggayfictionpodcast.com. And of course, we've got links to everything that we've talked about in this episode there too. And thanks so much to Adib for talking to us about The Breakup List. I really cannot recommend this book highly enough. I also cannot wait for the fall release of I'll Have What He's Having, because that sounds so incredible. All right, that's going to do it for now. Coming up on Monday, May 6th, Kat Sebastian's going to be here to talk to us about her new book, You Should Be So Lucky, which features a romance set in 1960 between a baseball player who's in a slump and the reporter who's been assigned to write about him. It's such a great book and a wonderful conversation. You are not going to want to miss it. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll be back here soon for more discussions about the kinds of stories that we all love, the big gay fiction kind. Until then, keep turning those pages and keep reading.
Big Gay Fiction Podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more shows you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts. Original theme music by Daryl Banner.